There we go. And let me mute. Okay, so I should have done that from the get-go, but we've now got no more background noise, and let's get started with the first case. Abby, I have your case in front of me, but for my sake as well as everyone else, I want to hear it direct from you, and for both of you today, as well as any of you who volunteer in the future, what I want you to try and do, because it does take some practice, I want you to get the hang of trying to present cases, no matter how complicated they might be, as succinctly as you possibly can. Typically within 30 seconds, because the time is so precious in the exam, they're not going to give you 1 or 2 minutes to present a case. So you've got to get to the gist of it right away. So with that in mind, Abby, go ahead, tell us about your case.
Okay, so this is a 56-year-old lady who came to see me for a pap smear that was HSIL. We did a colposcopy, and there was adenocarcinoma in situ on the ECC. She had had a cold knife cone a year ago, and she absolutely refused up one side and down the other to repeat that or to go see gynonc, and she said, you know, the only thing that she would do was a hysterectomy. So I counseled her, you know, about missing things potentially and various other things, and did the hysterectomy. I did a TLH, BSO. Pathology came back with a 1A1 cervical carcinoma. I am just, you know, obviously, I'm a generalist, so obviously this, like, isn't what I would have typically done or wanted to do, but it's kind of like where she left me because she wouldn't do the other things, so I just don't know how to really handle that. I want to make clear, obviously, that I would have done a diagnostic excisional procedure or sent her to gynonc or both, you know, depending on everything, and that's what I would do with anybody else, but she kind of put me.
Okay, so I hear the issue loud and clear, and this issue is just typical of actually the majority of questions that I get from candidates. And why is it typical? Because the answer is the same for all the majority of these questions. And that is, and you did a pretty good job of it, Abby, you've got to be, when presenting these cases, totally open and honest. That's the key thing. Let me ask you a question. Abby, do you think, given this, and we've got to be totally honest with ourselves here. So when I pose this question to you, Abby, I really want you to be genuinely honest with yourself. Do you think, given the circumstances, you did the right thing? Yes or no?
Given where she put me, yes, I think I did the right thing because it's better than
doing okay. Let me ask you the next question. If this same type of patient, clinical presentation, were to present to your office tomorrow, would you manage her in the same fashion?
Well, like I said, I tried to get her to do a diagnostic excisional procedure. So
no, you're beating around the bush. I said, given the exact set of circumstances,
then
would you manage her
the exact same thing?
Yeah, and both your answers to both my questions are 100% correct. Look, folks, the way Abby presented is correct, and I want to embellish on it a couple of things. Number one, this is a tough situation. The most important thing the most important question that Abby you will get, and any others, I'm sure many of you listening in have similar situations, or in the next 3 months will get similar situations to what we're describing. You've got to be comfortable to say totally honestly what happened. So it all comes down at the end of the day to how did you counsel her, and Abby mentioned that. So counseling has to be a very in-depth response that you can give. You've got to be able to get pros and cons, and alternatives. And at the end of the day, let me just role play the situation, and I ask you to notice how blatantly honest I am. I would say this was, and the words that I'm using, I'm choosing purposefully, and I encourage you to talk this way in the exam, because it shows you being open, honest, and sincere. I would say the following. You know, this was a very frustrating case for me, because we had a patient with high-grade SIL with an inadequate prior cone the year before. She needed repeat cone and possibly and probably hysterectomy. But before we proceeded to hysterectomy, there was an absolute need for me to rule out malignancy. And I counseled her on this approach, but no matter how I tried, she was not interested. She didn't want a repeat cone. She didn't want anything. She wanted to proceed just to hysterectomy. And given that situation, my thinking was, I can let this is not the ideal treatment. I can say no to this woman, and what would happen to her? She would run a real risk of going on to develop malignancy. And so I felt as long as I counseled her clearly on the pros and cons, risks and benefits, and she understood them, I felt this was the best option in a lousy situation. So I went ahead and did the hysterectomy, and you'll notice it came back invasive carcinoma. So this was the exact issue that I was concerned about. And I had to counsel her. Now she considered, or I got a gyn-onc opinion, and then you can talk, you know, on from that. But Abby, does what I say sound, does it ring well with you? Could you say that in the exam? Would you be comfortable to talk that way in the exam?
Yeah, because it honestly sounds like exactly what happened.
And the truth is, when I give an example like this, the response of the candidate typically is, you know, it sounds great because that's actually exactly what I was thinking. That's exactly what happened. And so say it. You come across open, honest, and transparent, and with integrity. So does that solve your primary issue?
Yes, I think it does.
Good. Now, this particular issue of a patient who doesn't want to have a repeat leap or cone to rule out malignancy, and you proceed straight to hysterectomy, one other bit of information that may not be, but may be appropriate to mention, especially if it's a postmenopausal woman, you can say, assuming it's true, I looked at this patient's cervix, and unfortunately, given the fact that she was postmenopausal and she had a rather large cold knife cone biopsy before, as much as I wanted to, there wasn't any cervix left that I could safely remove. And I considered the options. I even discussed it with a gyn-onc. There was a concern of, without a palpable cervix per se to feel, there was a concern that I might go into the bladder or the rectum. And so I counseled the patients on the options. These were the risks and benefits. I offered to send her to a gyn-onc, but she declined. She wanted to be operated in an area in which she could recover amongst the family. She understood the risks, and I went and did the procedure. So you can add that small cervix bit, that piece as well in this particular case. Not in other cases. Many of you listening don't have this exact same case, but you can have that as well. Had it come back not 1A1, by the way, any of you who've got any cancer, on your cases, you obviously have to know the staging of that particular cancer. That goes without saying. But to Abby and all, more important, the rest of you who are listening in, if you've got a situation like this, let's say you took a 40-year-old with an adnexal mass and to do an oophorectomy, and you get a surprise finding on path of some tumor, malignant tumor. That's a situation which some of you may have. It's the same kind of approach. And there you have to say why you didn't call in Jin Onk at the time. And you would say, you know, it was a smooth, not excessively large. She was young. It was unilateral. There was no solid components. It seemed to be filled with clear fluid. There were no papillations, excrescences. You're going to describe a very benign mass. And then it was a surprise finding that it came back malignant, okay? There was one other thing I wanted to mention, and I can't remember it right now. Yes, if she declines, let's go back to Abby's case. She declines the repeat cone, and Abby, you go ahead and do the hysterectomy, and it comes back CIN3, not invasive cancer. It's good to say, you change your presentation slightly, and you say the following. At the end of the day, the path came back CIN3, but I've got to be honest, we were lucky. There was a small chance it could have come back invasive carcinoma. You say that in the exam, because by doing that, you're giving an inch, but you're gaining a mile. You're acknowledging that you could have had an adverse outcome, but you're showing at the same time that you understand, this is what's important to the examiner, you understand the issues involved in a case such as that. And this is what the examiner is looking out for. So, Abby, does that make sense to you?
Yeah, it does. Thank you.
Any other questions on this case?
You mentioned you got another staging, and I kind of assumed and figured that. Trying to think about that, I don't know how to do a radical hysterectomy. They don't expect me to be able to walk them through that or anything, right?
No, it's sufficient to say, I mean, look, I'm a generalist. I would say a radical hysterectomy requires a wider dissection around the cervix. I'm aware of the a classification of the Rutledge classification of hysterectomy. I think it's 1 through 4. I'm just adding because this is off the top of my head. And the 1 takes a little bit extra tissue on the side, whereas 4 takes a lot. Obviously, the closer you get to 4, the more concern is for the ureter. The moment you say that, be prepared for a question on the anatomy, the course of the ureter. But no, they don't expect us how to do a radical hysterectomy. And this goes to everyone. Don't let an examiner intimidate you into doing a radical hysterectomy or a lymph node dissection unless you're a Jin Onk fellow, because by doing that you run the risk of killing the patient, and that would be regarded obviously in a very serious light. So you would even say, you know, I'm not trained, I would do this patient more harm than good, so I would close this patient and have it transferred and reopened if necessary by someone who is trained to do that lymph node dissection. Don't let them push and intimidate you into doing something that you're not trained to do. And another area where this may come is in your OB exam, when you're having a discussion on postpartum hemorrhage, which is probably the most common question in any OBGYN board exam, and you've gone through everything, you're now in the OR and you're doing all your surgical options, and they ask you, would you do a hypergastric artery ligation? And the response is, I would not do one because I'm more concerned with saving the patient's life than saving her uterus. And you score positively for doing that, okay? So I'm just giving you different scenarios. There's one one other point that probably a handful of you listening in, this is relevant for you. What is that? You go to get a subspecialty referral who says, be it OBGYN, whatever the case may be, we're going to do X. And you know that in this area of diagnosis, whatever it might be, that's really not the right thing. It's being overly aggressive. For example, you know you'd rather do Y. That's what the training is. But you refer the patient, the GYN did X. Now you've got X on your case list. You've got to defend it. How do you do that? And whenever you're placed in a situation where you've got to talk about someone else's case, all of those of you who are fellows, for example, your cases, or anyone who's using cases from residency, in those situations, you were not the one making the decisions. Your attending was. And so you don't have to defend what someone else did. Rather than defend it, I want you to take the approach where you critique it and show where the decisions were good and where, if necessary, whether you don't agree, where they were bad. But don't be rude, don't be impolite, and don't be unprofessional. Don't throw your attending under the bus. You know, you say, you know, this attending was really very good, and I'm most impressed with him or her, but in this particular issue, I don't agree with the management that he or she did. Be polite, okay? And so getting back, if you've got a patient who was managed by a subspecialist differently from how you understand these patients should be managed, the way to handle that situation is to say the following. You know, I referred this patient to Jin Onk, who recommended X. I was a little surprised because if I were to make a decision in this clinical situation, I would have gone with Y. But in the clinical context, I referred to the Jin Onk. He or she recommended X. I deferred to their senior training and understanding of the situation. And therefore, we went with X. And that's totally the appropriate thing to do. I would, just to be on the safe side, go one step further and say what the Jin Onk, in this case it's a Jin Onk, what the subspecialist would argue was in favor of doing Y rather than X. So you can share with the examiner what the subspecialist did and why he or she did it. So that's not your case, Abby, but it's something that several of you listening in will come across. Okay. What else? Abby, is there anything else in this case that you wanted to ask me?
I don't think so. Thank you very much.
All right, good. You're more than welcome. And you presented that case very nicely, by the way. Well done.
Thank you.
Sure. Adriana, are you there? Can you hear me? I've got a sneaking suspicion, Adriana, you signed in without a special code so you could be an active participant. So, folks, what I'm going to do so that we can hear Adriana, I'm going to unmute all of us. I'm going to ask all of you, please make sure there's no background noise because then it'll become impossible to hear her. So please make sure you're in a room where it's quiet in the background, and I'm going to unmute us now, and then I think we will be able to hear Adriana. So hold on one second. Okay. Adriana, can you hear me? Are you there?
Yes, hello?
Okay, yes, we got you. Okay.
We're all good.
So, okay, very good. You signed in with the wrong code, but not the end of the world. We've got you, and that's what counts. Adriana, same thing as I said to Abby. Go ahead and share with us the concern that you have regarding your case.
Sure. So this is the case of a 31-year-old G2, P2. She delivered at 40 weeks in one day. Her pregnancy was complicated by a maternal weight gain of 60 pounds, and she declined to complete her diabetic screening.
I'm cleaning up a little bit.
Sorry, Adriana, hold on 1 second. Whoever's got a little kid in the background, please, can I ask you to put them away somewhere else? Because none of us can hear Adriana. I'm sorry. I'm sorry to be so tough. But please, it's impossible otherwise for us to hear. Okay, Adriana, just briefly repeat what you said.
Okay,
I'm just sorry. Well, I'm going to interrupt one more time. Sorry, whoever's got that little baby, if you can't get a baby's a baby, needs to be with her mom or his mom. If you can't separate, can I ask you please to leave the seminar, come back in a short while maybe, or else listen to the archive. But otherwise it becomes impossible. Okay, that sounds a lot better. Whoever it was, thank you so much. Adriana, go ahead. Let's try again.
No problem. 31-year-old G2P2 delivered at 40 weeks. She had significant weight gain and declined her diabetic screen. So during her labor process, she delivered uneventfully a male neonate, intact perineum that weighed about 4,000 grams. And immediately after delivery, she had continual bleeding for the vagina. The QBL was 700. She received oxytocin, misoprostol, methergin, carboprost to help control the bleeding, and eventually bimanual exam was performed to remove the cotyledon of the placenta, and the bleeding subsided. And then after delivery, a small 1 centimeter hematoma was noticed at the midline of the perineum, and that was managed with vaginal packing, and which was later removed because it did not expand. So my question is, for the bleeding in the management part of the case log, should I just state polypharmacy or should I state everything I've done to help manage the bleeding?
Okay, this is a great question, and this is relevant to every single person, 100% of those listening in. There are two questions, number one, that you're really asking. Number one is, do I use specific names of the drugs, or do I just say polypharmacy? And with specific names, the question becomes, do I use trade names or generics?
Yeah.
And also, you can expand this question to virtually anything and everything. Do I put more down on paper and explain what happened in greater detail or less detail? So let's talk about the drugs first, and then I'll talk about the level of detail. With respect to the drugs, it's preferable that you use generics, not trade names. But if you're going to develop just the slightest degree of sweat trying to remember the generics, it's not worth it. Go with the trades. But as a general principle, if you can put down generics, it's more professional, okay? So I would encourage you, where possible, put down generics, but don't get gray hairs worrying about it. And that, what I've just said, goes for writing down on your case list as well as how you present verbally in the exam, both of them, okay?
Okay, got it.
Now, okay, let's address the other question. How expansive, how detailed should you be when telling your story, when writing down your story on the case list? And let me give the explanation first, and then you'll understand the answer clearly. If you write down every drug you gave her, every PPH treatment you gave her, starting with Pitocin, running through all your pharmacology, running through all your blood component therapy, running through all your surgical options, landing up with a hysterectomy, okay? If you write that all down, you've left yourself nothing to say. It's all down on paper. And keep in mind, if you're going to just simply read what's down on paper, you're not helping yourself, because the examiner can read it just as well as you can. You're not improving your lot. So you've put it all down on paper. The bottom line, you've left yourself nothing to say in the exam. And so for that reason, and this is really important at our cases construction course, I emphasize this a lot, and I give you examples of where this happens and how to do it. The key thing is to be word poor. We're talking about construction of the cases now, not oral exam technique. When writing down your case, be word poor. If you can say something in six words, don't use seven. And Adriana, what you said was along the right track. You were asking, should I list the individual drugs or should I just say polypharmacy? The basic principle is go with one word, polypharmacy. Okay, I'm going to give you even a better option, but polypharmacy is much better because, number one, you've left yourself a lot to say in terms of what medication you did give her. And when you're speaking as opposed to reading, you're actually scoring points. You're helping yourself. So that's very, very good. But I would encourage you, instead of saying polypharmacy, which is very enticing for the examiner to ask, what polypharmacy did you give her? Okay, that's the beauty of saying polypharmacy. It piques the examiner's curiosity, and they want to get a clarification. And in seeking out that clarification comes the question, what is the polypharmacy? And that's a question that is so easy to predict. You can prepare it before you walk into the exam, and you've got 3 minutes of your exam taken care of. You're scoring 100% on it. So I would strongly counsel against listing all the drugs. Just say polypharmacy. But what's even better, I'm trying to pique the examiner's curiosity as much as possible, because I'm comfortable to talk about medical treatment of PPH. And so I'm dying, I'm drooling at the thought of trying to get the examiner to ask me about PPH. What's the best way to do it? In my view, I would write down the following. I would say failed medical PPH management or failed PPH polypharmacy. I'd add the word failed because it's that much stronger and that much more likely to pique the examiner's curiosity. Why did it fail? What did you give? How much did you give? Did you give enough? You understand? That's where the curiosity lies. And once they ask you the first question, you've captured, so to speak. And I don't mean to belittle the examiners, but they're human beings, just like us. They think the same thought process. The psychology is the same for them as it is for us or any other human. You pique their curiosity, and you get the question you're looking for. So I strongly encourage you to be word poor. Give less rather than more. Don't overdo it, but for the example of postpartum hemorrhage, when I'm reviewing case lists, for example, what I will typically say, advise candidates to do, is in the treatment column, I advise them to write the following. Failed mechanical treatment. The examiner is wondering, what does he mean by mechanical treatment? So they'll ask you, what do you mean? And then I go and talk to them about uterine massage, bimanual compression. Okay? Then the next thing I write is failed medical therapy. I could write failed polypharmacy. That would be absolutely fine. Then I write failed hematological therapy. And what I'm referring to is blood transfusion. So if you write failed hematological therapy, you've got to be comfortable, which or every single one of you needs to know this, regardless if you've got a PPH patient on your list or not. You've got to know blood component therapy. It's one of the few things, topics that you need to know in reasonable detail. By the way, and I know I've said this many times before. We know from history, virtually every single one of you listening are coming to the Definitive Board Prep course later on in the year. We're going to have a 1.25 or 1.5 hour session. That's how important this is on PPH. And we're going to include the kind of depth that you need to know blood component therapy. And so, you know, we'll have you covered. You don't need to worry about that. So I will drive failed hematological therapy, and then I would write failed conservative surgical therapy. And here I'm talking about suturing up lacerations, an O'Leary stitch, a balloon. You can even be prepared, not that you would do it, but if you're going to write that down, be prepared how some people, not you, might consider doing a bilateral hypogastric artery ligation. And how do you do that, and what's the anatomy? Most people would not want to get involved in that conversation, but just FYI. And then the very last thing that I would put down would be hysterectomy. So I've got failed medical, failed mechanical, failed pharmacotherapy, failed hematological therapy, failed conservative surgical therapy, and the last line would be hysterectomy. It's all in like a bulletless fashion. That's how I would put it down. And when the examiner sees that, I think you would agree with me that they're going to be almost compelled to ask for more details as to what actually happened. So, Adriana, does that make sense to you, what I said?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, are you comfortable with that? Are you comfortable writing it up accordingly?
Yes, I am. And also, because her QEL was 700, like, she doesn't meet the criteria for postpartum hemorrhage, so I kind of wanted to label this under perineal hematoma. But can I do that even though it was just a small hematoma? I mean, she only needed a vaginal pack for like 6 hours.
Okay, you know what I would do? I would encourage you to do this. You might not be comfortable. I would put PPH in it's not inverted commas are two little things on either side, but which are quotes, but just one little chook on the top. I don't know what you call it. What's the English term for the grammatical term for one when you quote, not inverted commas? I think it's just a quote unquote. I'm not sure, but you know what I'm saying. I would write PPH quote unquote PPH. What you're really saying is, it's not really a PPH. You're acknowledging on paper that you know the difference. And if they ask you, why did you call this a PPH? There was only a 700cc EBL. You say, you'll notice I put it in quotes because you're baiting the examiner to ask you. And you've shown on paper that before he asked you or she asked you the question, you understood what the issue was. It's not like, you know, they asked you the question, now you're just fumbling for a correct answer. You knew this beforehand by putting it in quotes or whatever it is, the grammatical term. I hear you, it's not officially a PPH, but would you agree with me, she's behaving like a PPH? Yes? No? What do you think? It's
yeah.
A clinical judgment. Yeah.
Yeah,
so you say, you know,
as if it was.
Yeah, you say, you know, notice, I put this in quotes because officially this did not come to the reach the magnitude of a formal postpartum hemorrhage, but she was behaving clinically as a PPH, and for that reason I called it as such. Okay, so you show the examiner, I understand the issues involved here. Does that make sense to you?
Yes, yes, thank you.
All right. One other thing I just want to mention. You can, you know, a lot of you will get this question, and it's a bit of a trick question. A hematoma of the perineum, and more importantly, a hematoma of the broad ligament. These are, especially the latter, but also the former, these are almost classical favorite exam type questions. I don't care if you're taking the ABOG exam or the AOBOG exam or the British exam or the Canadian exam, wherever you are, these are classical questions, okay? And you must be very wary of allowing yourself to be pushed into a situation where you open up the broad ligament or you open up the perineum. The treatment is, as Adriana did, to pack and do your utmost to avoid opening. Because once you open the broad ligament, you're in unknown territory as far as us being generalists are concerned. And you could say the same thing for the perineum. So just be aware you want to avoid being pressured into opening up either the broad ligaments for an expanding hematoma or the perineum, okay? All right. Adriana, do you have any other questions on this particular case, or are you comfortable?
No, that's perfect. Thank you.
All right. So it was good for you. All right. Excellent. Look, we're almost out of time. Just by the way, I was reading my MOC article that came out about 6 weeks ago now, 8 weeks ago or so. There was an article which has really got a lot of exam relevance. All of you are familiar with it, but the updated guidelines on pap smears, and it's not so new anymore, but the fact that it came up as a MOC article just makes it fresh in the examiner's mind, and therefore I think you need to be familiar with this. Again, we'll give you the list of articles at the course later on in the year, the definitive board prep course. But the one thing I wanted to emphasize that is a change from the previous set of guidelines, which I think were issued somewhere around 2012 as opposed to 2019, I think. Whereas previously the algorithms were based on risk factors and results of the various tests. Now they're based on that, but it's primarily based when you put together all the risk factors and results. If that translates into a risk of developing cancer of 4% or more, that is the cutoff that warrants treatment. So just be aware, it's gone from a results, from a risk factors based algorithm to a risk of developing malignancy based algorithm. That's the point, the key point that I wanted you folks to be aware of. And again, we'll give you the title of the article so you can help you get you in sync with your examiner, whatever he or she is reading. But that's not for now. I'm just giving you a heads up. Right now, you need to be spending all your time doing your cases, putting all your energy into the cases. I actually don't want you to be studying right now. Your case list represents 50% of your exam. You're three-quarters way collecting cases. You need to, each and every one of you, need to write up the perfect case list for you. Because each of you have a different comfort level with different topics. Each of you are comfortable or uncomfortable to discuss certain topics and not others. And you need to write up your cases in such a way that it's going to generate the kind of questions you want. And those of you who have not yet come to our case list construction course, you're saying, what the hell does he mean? How can I write my case list up in a way that I can get the questions I want? Sounds crazy. The truth is, it's incredibly easy and straightforward. And those of you who have come to our course will understand exactly what I'm talking about. So I'll get my plug in. For those of you who have not yet come to the course, I really, really want to strongly encourage you to attend. It's a one-day course. You can listen to it online on a day of your choosing, or perhaps a night or two nights. But it really will give you, it'll change the way you look at your cases totally, strongly. In fact, I will go so far as to say that out of all the products and services that we provide, the one that'll give you the most bang for the least time and money is our cases construction course. It's just so damn good. And it's not just me saying it. Yeah, all the candidates over the years that have come, everyone raves about it. So if you haven't yet attended and you're thinking of attending, come as soon as you possibly can. The sooner the better. And if you haven't decided yet, I would strongly encourage you to attend. So I'm not going to plug this anymore. I just want to go back to Abby for 1 second. Abby, comments on the experience of presenting this case, your case, to everyone listening in. What would you say?
I think it was really helpful because I can't tell you how many times that I've like replayed doing this in my mind, but I haven't really done it for anybody. So I just felt like getting it out there and kind of stumbling through it a little bit and figuring out what felt right to say was incredibly helpful.
Good, good. Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Adriana, how about you? What's your opinion of your experience today? And you can say it was terrible. I don't mind. I've got broad shoulders. Yeah. I want you to be totally open, honest, and transparent.
No, I agree. The more you talk about your cases, the more comfortable I feel like I'll feel for the exam, and it'll just help in the end.
Yeah, I agree totally. You folks have to get comfortable talking about your cases. Absolutely excellent point. All right, folks, look, before we sign off, because I like to keep this at 45 minutes, our next teleseminar is going to be on the 23rd of April. That's 3 weeks away. Usually we're every 2 weeks. I'm not quite sure what's on the calendar that dictated the need to do this on the 23rd, but that's what I was told is when the next one's going to be. So just FYI, 23rd of April, unless you hear something to the contrary, 23rd of April is when our next teleseminar will be. I want to thank Abby and Adriana and everyone else who was listening in. Thank you so much, and I look forward to doing this again. Please tell your friends to come and join us. It's free. Your friends and colleagues, let them come and join us. It's really, want to encourage that as much as possible. All right, folks, thanks to everyone, and we'll speak again in 3 weeks. Take care. This concludes the end of our teleseminar.